This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans. Many cities are looking for ways to address a lack of affordable housing. A new working paper from the Upjohn Institute for Employment Research looks at whether simply building more housing, even at higher prices, helps drive down the cost in middle and lower income neighborhoods. Evan Mast is the author of the working paper and an economist at the Upjohn Institute. Thank you for being here.
Thanks for having me on.
So how can more housing, which maybe even is a little high priced, or maybe luxury condominiums, help bring down the price for someone who is looking for an affordable place to live?
Yeah, so I always like to explain this just with an example that's, you know, local to wherever I'm talking, wherever the person I'm talking to is from. And in Kalamazoo, we have a couple good examples right now because we have sort of this Exchange Place building, which you might have seen go up. I think it's at like Rose in West Michigan. And then you have this other one at Rose Street in Lovell. And both of these are new apartment buildings, largely rental. I don't think either has any condos. And they're coming in kind of above the price point that we think of for the typical one bedroom in Kalamazoo. So I looked up the Rose and Lovell one bedrooms are like $1,200 to $1,600. I think of one bedrooms in Kalamazoo as more like $700 to $900. So it seems like, whoa, this is coming in way above market. How is this going to make anything more affordable in Kalamazoo? And the key thing that lets these expensive new apartments affect the rest of the housing market that includes, you know, cheaper units is that people actually move into these new buildings, right? So, for example, the one at Rose and Lovell, I have two coworkers that looked and saw units there. One would be moving from a little bit cheaper unit downtown. So I think his apartment rents for probably around $1,000. And the other is coming potentially from Portage, and that would be more like a $700 or $800 unit. So if these guys move in to the new building at Rose and Lovell, they're going to leave behind vacancies at their old apartment buildings. Those are going to be at those cheaper price points that I just laid out. And that's going to help to loosen the market, you know, for these units that are in the more typical $700, $900 range.
You described something called Yes in My Backyard, and this would be an example of that, of saying, yes, please come to Kalamazoo, put these apartments downtown. Yes, they're higher priced than maybe a typical person can afford, but by saying yes in my backyard, you're saying that there is some ripple effect.
That was sort of the next thing I wanted to go into, is exactly this ripple effect. So, you know, not only do my two coworkers move into the new building and leave behind their slightly cheaper units, you also can imagine that another person moves into the units that are left behind by my old coworkers, and they come from slightly cheaper apartments still. So maybe they move into the $800 apartment from an apartment that costs $600, and then now we've created a vacancy at the $600 price point. And, you know, these numbers seem small when it's just, I'm just talking anecdotally about two coworkers, but, you know, I believe these two buildings in downtown Kalamazoo each have about 150 units. So it's about 300 units total that you're creating. And, you know, that can create a substantial number of vacancies once you bring it up to that scale.
In some cities, there would be a requirement that you have to have so many units at a certain point deemed more affordable. Does your research indicate that a policy like that may not loosen the market the way that this example you've spelled out does?
So I think there are trade-offs to putting in those requirements. So these are often called like AROs, affordability requirement ordinances. And it says, okay, if you want to build 200 market rate apartment units, you're going to have to include 20 income restricted units that are going to have to be affordable to someone with the median income for the city, maybe, or someone, you know, lower at like the 20th percentile of income. And the benefit to these income restricted units is that you're sort of offering something that you know exactly the price it's going to rent for. You know exactly the place that it's going to be. It's going to be, you know, in this neighborhood that's maybe desirable for whatever reason that people with these incomes couldn't typically afford. So that's the benefit. The trade-off is that if the developer builds fewer units because they have to meet these affordability requirements, we might not see as many market rate buildings go up. You know, there could be some building where suppose it pencils out, the developer thinks they can make a profit if they don't have to provide any affordable units. But if they have to provide 10% affordable units, maybe that flips the project, it doesn't happen, and now we're out 100 units, 100 market rate units that otherwise we would have had. And because of this ripple effect mechanism that I just described, losing those market rate units is actually going to have an impact on the lower income housing market, because we're not going to create those vacancies that we would have seen if we built those expensive new units.
You do, however, spell out in your report that there are ways that the chain may not make it all the way down to somebody who is in a low-income neighborhood. What are the things that prevent the chain from working as well as it might if it goes perfectly the way you described it earlier?
Yeah, so that's right. Not every new unit is going to create this chain that goes on forever. So you could think of a couple different things that could end this chain. One, which I think is probably less of a problem in Kalamazoo than, say, New York City, is that someone could buy that condo or rent that apartment and use it as just like a second home or a weekend crash pad or some kind of investment property. And then, you know, we're not really creating any more vacancies down the chain, because that person's holding on to their main house. They're just using this when they want to, you know, stay in the city for a weekend.
Could happen in a big city. That could also happen maybe in a city which is near, say, Lake Michigan, where people mm-hmm. might think this is my place to get away and be near the lake.
That's right.
You know, for the weekend and maybe for a couple weeks in the summer.
Definitely. Yeah. Also vacation areas for sure. You know, another thing could be if someone, you know, is moving out of their parents' house for the first time. They were living in the basement. They move into a unit. Parents don't bring a new tenant into the basement, that's going to end the chain too. Those are sort of the two big ones that I like to focus on.
Is there any sort of a lag time here from where, you know, we get, say, your two coworkers moving in to these higher priced apartments, you know, kind of making a step up from what they've been paying before, and that filtering down to a lower or a middle income neighborhood?
Yeah, so there's a bit of a lag time. It's not huge when you're looking at this mechanism, because all you need is for people to move. So the typical apartment right now sits vacant for about a month before it gets rented. So that, and if you look at home sales, it's kind of around the same right now, maybe a little bit longer. So it's going to take like 1 to 3 months for each round of this chain to happen. And in the paper, I find that most of the action happens within like 10 to 15 rounds of the chain. So that translates to like 3 to 5 years for these effects to be fully felt. And that's a little different. I think a lot of people get a little bit confused between this mechanism I just talked about, where it's people moving, and the idea that, well, once those new apartments get old, they're not going to seem so fancy anymore and they're going to be cheaper, which, you know, you could see that taking 30 years or 40 years or whatever it might be. But this version, this story where people are just moving, it can happen much faster.
So does your paper make an argument for less regulation on new housing in any given city?
I would say in general, yes. I think where it really enters the debate is often you'll have people debating some new housing development. You know, you can picture the community meeting where you've got the people that live in the neighborhood. Some are for it, some are against it, some are mad about parking, some are excited about the new grocery store. You know, you've got the city officials that are trying to decide if they should actually approve this thing. And an argument that people will make that don't like these developments is often, well, these units aren't going to do anything for our housing problem. These are expensive. These are just going to, you know, house rich yuppies. Why do we want to, you know, give up our nice neighborhood for that? And my paper says, well, maybe we shouldn't take that argument as seriously, because there are these ripple effects. So if you want to argue against the new housing, fine, but that particular dimension of your argument doesn't seem to totally stand up to scrutiny.
Are there policies which can keep that ripple effect going, or can try to strengthen that chain so that it doesn't end too quickly, as you pointed out it can?
So I think so, yeah. The big one to me that could maybe be moved by a policy is preventing homes from sitting vacant or being used as a second home. So, for example, the city of Vancouver was really worried about this. They were worried that a lot of capital, a lot of, you know, wealthy people from overseas were basically using Vancouver housing as an investment property. So they put in place some taxes that said, you know, if we find evidence that no one's living in this house, you're going to have to pay X dollar penalty. So that would be an example of something that prevents you know, these new apartments from being used as second homes or investment properties. I will say that when Vancouver went and crunched the numbers on this after a couple years of the tax, they found that this problem was not as pervasive as a lot of people think. You know, they actually had the electrical utility go in and look at how much electricity each house was using and kind of the pattern of how the units were using electricity. And it pointed to something like less than 1 or 2% of the units in the city being consistently vacant.
Are there external factors here which may change the equation? I'm just thinking, you know, economic factors, you know, that in a good economy, there are certain things that may apply, and perhaps in a not so strong economy, you know, taking, you know, maybe the housing crisis of 08 as a big outlier. But are there external economic factors that also will push this one way or another?
So I think the economy will largely kind of dictate how fast this mechanism goes. So in a booming economy or strong housing market, houses are getting snapped up on the market really quickly. Apartments aren't staying vacant for very long. So each round of the chain is not going to take as long. If we go back to like 2010, the vacancy rates were much higher. Home time on the market was, you know, several times as long as it is now. So this mechanism would just take longer to happen.
Does the size of the community matter? In other words, you looked a great deal at larger cities, often, you know, the city of Chicago. You know, does this apply to Chicago in a way that it applies differently to Kalamazoo?
So in some ways, yes. In some ways, no. I will say I looked specifically at kind of these big multifamily developments in city centers. So more like the examples I used in Kalamazoo, as opposed you could also think of, you know, some new tract homes going up kind of on the exurbs. So my guess is that my analysis would extend from the new, you know, the new multifamily towers to those exurban homes. But I didn't look at that specifically, so I don't want to overgeneralize. I think a big thing that matters, maybe more than size, is just what the housing market is like. So for example, I was in the Bay Area for graduate school, and there—
The Bay Area, San Francisco?
Yeah, San Francisco Bay Area. And there, you know, if you were making $150,000, you were not buying a house. You were not having a very nice apartment. Everything's very expensive. Your money just doesn't go very far. And there, when you talk about housing affordability, people not being able to afford big, good housing— It was pretty clear to me that this was a housing policy problem because housing was priced so much more, so much higher than it should be. Like if you think about how much it actually cost to build housing, that was much less than the prices apartments were renting and houses were selling for. In Kalamazoo, I don't think that's really the case. I think that generally when we talk about an affordable housing problem, you know, we're saying, well, for the typical income or for, you know, the 20th percentile income, housing just eats up a ton of that. And people do not have enough disposable income when housing costs this much. And in the case of Kalamazoo, I think that if that's the case, it's probably because wages are too low, not because housing prices are too high. You know, just looking around at apartments in the city, like I said, you have a lot of places that are renting, you know, one bedrooms for $700. That's cheap. And there are places that are cheaper than that. And at a certain point, you just— Housing is about, it's being rented for about the price it takes a landlord to maintain it. You know, the landlord has to pay property taxes, has to keep the place running, has to pay for their time that they spend on it. And I just don't know if you can always reduce housing prices. Or I should say, I don't know if Kalamazoo can, in general, reduce housing prices further than it is. I think in some cases, it's a wage problem here.
Does the chain, if it works as well as we hope, does it get down to the person who right now is struggling to find a place that they can afford to rent, even at the lowest rents we have in the city?
So that's a great question. I typically mentioned that earlier because I think that's a really big and important kind of caveat to what I say, is I think this chain mechanism that I describe can definitely help middle-income people, can help working-class people. But if you're looking at the very lowest income, where, like you said, you can't really afford even the cheapest apartment that a landlord can offer, the landlord isn't going to take a loss on that property. So we can't really think about lowering the rent for that property because, you know, the landlord's going to pull it off the market if they have to lower the price anymore. So I don't think that the chain is really a great way to target that segment of the market. I think there we need to either think about either, you know, subsidies and voucher programs of the kind we have. And another thing that doesn't get talked about very much is you can try to reduce the cost that it takes a landlord to offer housing. I haven't seen as many programs that do that, but you could imagine either reducing property taxes for landlords that are renting to low-income tenants. You could also imagine if maybe there are things in the building code that make maintaining an apartment more expensive than it needs to be, and there's not really a benefit for the renter. I think that's something that cities should look into more.
Evan Mast is an economist at the Upjohn Institute for Employment Research in Kalamazoo. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you.
You can find his working paper on housing and affordability at upjohn.org, and also links to his research at WMUK.org. WMUK's West Southwest podcast is available at WMUK.org and the WMUK app. You can subscribe through Apple Podcasts and by searching podcasts in Google Music. This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans.